Good afternoon and welcome to the Exploration Update with Orania Resources Conference Call. Throughout the call, your lines will be muted. However, at the end of the call, you'll have the opportunity to ask questions. If you need assistance, please press star zero and you will be connected to an operator. I'm now handing you over to Derek Matheson to begin today's conference.
Thank you. I'd like to welcome everybody to this update call with Orania Resources. My name is Derek Matheson. I'm the VP Mining Analysis at Red Cloud Klondike Strike Inc. I have with me on the call Keith Barron, Chairman and CEO, and Richard Spencer, President and Director of Orania. Before we get started, I need to mention the cautionary statements, disclaimers, and disclosures. For Orania Resources Limited, there will be some forward-looking statements made on this call. I would direct listeners to note the forward-looking statements on page two of Orania's corporate presentation located in the investor section of the company's corporate website. For Red Cloud Klondike Strike Inc., please see the full disclaimer and disclosures on our most recent Orania Resources post on our Rockstock blog on our website. I would highlight that this call is for information purposes only and should not be considered a solicitation to purchase or sell securities or a recommendation to buy or sell securities. And we note that this call does not take into account the particular situation or needs of individual investors. Participants should rely on their own investigations and seek their own professional advice before investment. Red Cloud specific disclosures related to Orania Resources. In the last 12 months, Red Cloud has been retained under a servicer advisory agreement by Orania. In the last 12 months, Red Cloud has received compensation for investment banking services for Orania. And Red Cloud or a member of the Red Cloud team or household has a long position in the shares and or options of Orania. The format of the call is a conversation between myself, Keith, and Richard, followed by questions from the line. We may reference Orania's corporate presentation, which is under the investor section of Orania's website. Thank you for joining me, Keith and Richard. Perhaps let's start with an overview of some of your recent activities at the Lost Cities Kudu project in Ecuador.
Thanks, Jack. Thank you. So,
yeah.
You want me to say that?
No, into there. Just answer that question there.
Okay. Things are moving ahead quite rapidly. We've made a couple of press releases very recently. About our some new things that have turned up. First of all, at Crunchy Hill. Crunchy Hill is an epithermal type mineral showing. The reason we call it Crunchy Hill is because it's the hill in question is being held up by kind of a fine network of quartz veins and iron oxides. It's really the remains of an area that's been deeply weathered. So there are a lot of void spaces in the rock where it's been washed away or chemically dissolved. And when you stand on this stuff and walk on it, it's actually crunchy underfoot. It's like stepping on cornflakes. So that's the reason we call it Crunchy Hill. So the fact that it's it really is flooded with silica and has a lot of iron oxides in it is very, very encouraging for us. This was found through stream sediment work, and the target has been enhanced since with soil geochemistry. So we did a soil grid over top of the original showing, but since then, the boys in the field have traced this thing for another 1,000 meters laterally to the west, and now that original grid is being extended out to the west. But as it stands right now, the target itself, outlined by Pathfinder Elements for Gold, is about 300 meters across, and certainly it's going to be interesting in the future. What we intend to do with this, we would like to trench it with an excavator to see what the dip is on it and which way it's trending. And then we'd like to do an IP survey. That's an induced polarization geophysical survey over top of it to see where the sulfides are lying at depth.
Great. That's and maybe just tell us a little bit why in your most recent release on Crunchy Hill you said this was one of the first target you wanted to drill. Maybe let us know why that why does this target stand out versus the others?
Well, it's the most advanced one. That's the only reason. The other ones will get there in time, but it does take time to develop these things as targets. You know, it does take a bit of time to get things turned around at the lab, anywhere from 4 to 6 weeks to get our results back. So these things are all progressing at various paces. We have five targets within the Latore area, which is a 10 by 10 kilometer area, and we're still doing stream sediments within that 10 by 10 area. So there's going to be more stuff certainly coming to the fore. We would like to have a number of targets kind of in the same stage of development before we drill them. So we don't want to just drill one target and then walk away and come back later on. We'd like to have four or five of them in the can ready to go later on this year. We're talking around, say, maybe October, November of this year to initiate drilling.
And Derek, that's certainly our approach throughout the area. I mean, out in front, we've got the reconnaissance crews, the young, really fit guys leading the reconnaissance and stream sediment sampling teams. And then behind that, we've got the guys with more experience coming in and developing those specific targets and moving them towards drill targets. And then the third leg of that will be the actual man-portable drill rig behind those groups. And as Keith said, we would drill Crunchy Hill first, but then we would hope and we would plan for that rig not to leave the project from Crunchy. It would go on to the next target, which the guys are working on at the moment, and we would keep that sequence of the reconnaissance guys out front, the sort of target development guys behind them, and the rig following behind them throughout the area.
Sure, that's a good approach. Now let's talk about a target you recently announced to the market, Chirip. What do you like about it so far, what you've learned so far, and then what are the next steps there?
Well, I think the most exciting thing about it is there are two things. The first one is the textures. We're seeing the same kind of quartz that we first saw in the Latore area, and I think the critical thing about this is that it's 50 kilometers from Latore, so it's a completely separate epithermal target, which is the main target that we're going for gold in the area. And then the other critical thing is that we had identified this area as having potential for porphyry copper gold from the geophysics. And in that press release that we put out last week, we show an image that shows three red blobs, and those red blobs had been identified as porphyry targets. And these epithermal textures are coming from right next to one of those red blobs. And typically, and Fruta del Norte is a classic example of this, typically you have a porphyry copper or copper gold deposit at depth and then an epithermal over the top of it or lateral to it. And at Fruta del Norte, there are porphyries on both sides of the gold deposit, copper porphyries, and the gold deposit is preserved between two faults that have sort of dropped it down to the same level as the porphyry. So originally, Fruta del Norte or FDN would have been over the top of a porphyry deposit, and that's the same sort of relationship that we're seeing at Chirip, and that's why we're excited about it.
Yeah, there's been some deep geophysics done at Fruta del Norte, and they have identified a porphyry at depth. You know, porphyries have a gold systems and porphyries have a strong relationship. For instance, Yanacocha in Peru, that started as a gold target, and now they're transitioning into a porphyry deep down in the pits. This is not something very unusual.
Great. Sounds very interesting. And let's finish up with the first target you guys identified, Awacha. What have you been doing recently there, and what are the next steps for that target?
Derek, you know, that again is tens of kilometers from any of these other targets that we've been talking about. And, You know, we originally said that there was quartz sericite alteration there, and the importance of quartz sericite is that that is the kind of alteration that you see as a sort of onion skin around porphyry copper or porphyry copper gold deposits. So it's a very interesting geological, it's the kind of geological rock that you want to see there, close to a porphyry deposit. But we wanted to understand the, make sure that we knew how that quartz sericite pyrite alteration tied in into the geology of that area. And so we've been doing some follow-up work there. And what we're finding is that that quartz sericite pyrite or QSP alteration is in a whole bunch of fingers, and each one of those fingers is 30 to 50 meters thick. And what that means is that we're actually lateral to a porphyry. You know, if they were vertical, they would be sticking up over the top of the porphyry. And we're not seeing that. We're seeing them as lateral fingers, which means that the porphyry has got to be exposed more or less at that same altitude in that area. And at this stage, we've only been working in one dimension. We've been working in a couple of streams that are close together. And the work that's going on there now is focused on getting a second dimension into that by sampling the streams and mapping the streams around that area so that we can know, okay, these lateral fingers of QSP that we're seeing, are they coming from the main porphyry, which is to the south, to the west, to the east, to the north, whatever of those streams that we originally worked in. So it's getting the second dimension involved in that picture, and ultimately with geophysics and drilling, we'll start working in the third dimension.
Very, very interesting. And I guess taking this back to the beginning of Orania, when I was first introduced to it, how does this all fit in with the Lost City search that sort of kicked off this company?
Well, the Lost Cities are certainly an important part of a component of what we're doing. You know, working in the area to the south with Aurelian back in 2003, we did find a Spanish tunnel. We know that it was Spanish because it had chisel marks on the walls, and the indigenous people living there didn't have anything harder than bronze. And these were made with steel. So obviously it was a Spanish tunnel, and that was found through stream sediment work. Now, what generally happened, the Spaniards would throw the waste rock from the mine into any kind of depression they could fill up, so they would throw it down the valley. It would end up in the streams, and it would get picked up. We picked it up in the stream sediments. There really is no way for these things to hide. If we do the stream sediments diligently and we have the proper coverage, we will find these things through stream sediment techniques. However, everyone keeps asking me, What about the Lost Cities? How close are you to finding the Lost Cities? Well, we've identified a couple of techniques that we're going to use to speed this thing up. Now, first of all, there is a technique that we'll be talking about fairly soon where you can use historical information to more or less turn the area into probability cells and rate them in terms of what the probability of the Lost Cities are going to be within those cells. And by cells, I mean it's like areas that are, say, 5 kilometers by 10 kilometers. So you break the topography up into blocks and you give them a number, and then you go for the ones that are the most likely. In this case, the way that we would, you know, it would be impossible for us to do, you know, close examination of 208,000 hectares. So how do you zero in on this stuff? Well, we can zero in using this technique, and then what we would do is probably a LIDAR survey over top of it. And a LIDAR survey is light direction and range. The way that it works, a laser is fired at the ground. Now, when it's fired over the jungle, Most of it will be reflected back to a detector by the leaves in the forest and the branches and whatnot, but a certain very small percentage gets all the way to the ground. And if you're firing off bursts of billions and billions of bursts of energy from these lasers, you can actually form a map of the the surface underneath the tree cover. So this has been done recently, very recently, by National Geographic and University of Houston in Guatemala, where a lost city was found. It's also been used in Honduras. It's been used in Cambodia. So we know that the technique works, and it works in areas that are just as thick in forest as we see here. The other thing that we want to do is an infrared survey, because you got to remember that the surface, the ground surface in this area is during the heat of the day will be maybe 25, 30 degrees centigrade. And if there are any mine openings anywhere, you're going to have cold air issuing to the surface. And it's an easy way to pick these up using thermal imaging. You can pick up anywhere where there are holes in the ground. So I think combining these two techniques, we could potentially find the lost cities pretty rapidly.
Okay. And then with respect to the wider properties, is there anything else you'd like to mention regarding your ongoing exploration activities?
Well, I think, you know, when we started the exploration in the Lost Cities Kitukul project, we looked as an analogy to the area to the south of us that's got 30 billion pounds of copper in various copper porphyries and 26 million ounces of gold in not only tied up with the porphyries, but in epithermal deposits as well. And we looked at our ground, which is an extension to that area, and thought, okay, well, we're likely to have multiple targets and hopefully multiple deposits on this area. And I think that that's exactly what we're finding. I mean, between Awacha and Sharip and La Torre being so many tens of kilometers apart, we're seeing three different districts there. And then Crunchy Hill just happens to be the first one within that La Torre 100 square kilometer area that we're following up and is likely to be the first drill target. But as Keith mentioned, I mean, after that we expect to have probably a second target probably at La Torre ready for scout drilling. So multiple targets.
Okay. And then from a corporate perspective, do you want to talk about any of the recent activities you guys have undertaken that continue to make Aurania unique relative to its peers?
Well, it's one hell of a story. And people, they love following the videos. We are going to continue with that program. And I think that's quite unique because we're in an incredible setting. And you know, people love kind of vicariously following along with what we're doing in the field. And also it's very impactful with the media. So in October of last year, we had Bloomberg Business Week out to the property, and that was written up in December. And then more recently, we had Vice HBO out of the property for 10 days, and they produced a bunch of videos that have been out on the net and actually out on TV. And in fact, as a result of the Vice coverage, just in this last week, I've had two approaches to put us on TV, like in a regular series. I don't know how any of our listeners here might feel about that. Richard and I showing up on your TV every week, but certainly this is it's very gratifying. It's something that we're kind of taking, let me say, semi seriously. We don't want it to be too intrusive in actually the work that we're doing, but it is a very unique way to connect with the general public, generate transparency in what we do.
and hopefully connect with some new investors.
That's exciting. I really enjoyed the Vice News piece for sure. Going forward, as we look over the next few months, what can we expect as additional news items from you guys?
Well, I expect just like Cherub just showed up out of the blue, we'll have other targets which will be showing up as a result of the stream sediment work that we're doing and the step-by-step investigation of the magnetic targets. So this is ongoing. You know, at the end of the day, I don't know how many targets we're going to end up having on the whole project, but it's certainly going to be many, many more than we already have found. I want everyone to realize that this is not a one-shot wonder. If we drill Crunchy Hill and it doesn't come up to our expectations, we intend to have a whole bunch of other things that are also moving ahead, if not at the same pace, but very, very closely behind. And so I think we're going to have a lot of news to get out there. I expect you know, there'll be stuff coming out almost on a weekly or bi-weekly basis here. And it's going to be very exciting when we get to the drill stage.
So in terms of the news flow, I mean, our approach is actually boringly methodical. The guys who are out in front to identifying the areas in the stream sediment sampling that are enriched in metals. And then this area has these magnificent orange soils, magnificent from a geological perspective, that are just really, really efficient at capturing any metal ions that are moving with the surface water. So we would always go from stream sediment sampling to then soil sampling on the edges of those streams. And when I say the edges, within, you know, sort of 500 meters of the streams. And so as Keith is saying, each target that we identify is going to have its own set of soil samples, exactly the way we've done for Crunchy Hill, that are illustrating the size and the location of the target, and that will be the main step towards advancing that project to drilling.
All right. Lots to look forward to. Thank you, Keith and Richard. Liz, let's open the call to questions from the line.
If you would like to ask a question, please press star 1 on your telephone keypad. You'll be advised when to ask your question. The first question comes from Terence Ortston. Please go ahead.
Good afternoon. It's Terence Ortston. Thank you for hosting this conference call, guys. Just maybe feedback on the ground with respect to what's happening, with respect to the environmental issues, the past ones that you talked about in the past in different presentations, reception of the indigenous to your work, their cooperation, and as well as the morale of the people that you're employing with respect to the exploration programs.
Terence, thanks very much. I mean, you know, I think the first thing is that you know, both Keith and I have quite a long history in an area that's just adjacent to that. We worked with the Shuar local communities in that area to the south as well. You know, we have a very switched on corporate social responsibility group. You know, the first step that we took in that area was advertise for jobs and everything, not only in Spanish, but in Shuar as well. And apparently that was one of the first companies to ever do that. And so right from the get-go, you know, we've reached out to those local communities to form part of our exploration and management groups there, and we've just gone from strength to strength on that. In fact, our geological groups are our reconnaissance teams are being augmented groups, exploration groups led by the Shuar, or individuals from the Shuar community. So, you know, we're just getting more and more ingrained in that area. And, you know, having the local people leading some of our exploration teams and that kind of thing just creates total transparency between us and the community. So, you know, obviously we are extremely cautious and very careful of our relationship with those communities, as we are with the government or anyone else down there, and obviously with our shareholders too. And the same goes for the environmental side of it. I think, you know, all of us are probably rabid environmentalists. And, you know, we want to make sure that what we do down there is the same kind of thing that we would be prepared to do in our back garden here. And, you know, so we will uphold our environmental work to the highest standards, and you know, we're using the local communities to help us with that in monitoring and advising us as to what to do, as well as complying with the various regulations and things.
And your exploration team, the morale, the turnover, the expectation, how they're working out in terms of expertise and also their commitment to work?
The commitment is absolutely huge. I mean, you know, the fundamental thing is it's showing respect for the guys on the ground, and true respect. I mean, that isn't just words. You know, the reconnaissance teams, our main criterion on them is that they've got to be Rambo types. They've got to be young, strong, fit, and motivated. And, you know, experience isn't a huge factor there. More important is to get the guys to where they need to be. And, you know, we will build up their experience. I mean, and in fact, what we plan to do is bring really, really top-class consultants in, and we've spoken to two specific consultants that will come in and do training in the field on our own targets with our entire geological group. That's the less experienced guys and the more experienced. So, you know, rather than sending the guys to courses externally, we're going to bring the consultants to them so they get trained on their own material.
Maybe just one last question. Stock price has been kind of stuck around here, with respect to 2.5, 3, depending on the market situation every day, and the volume is still pretty meager in terms of trading. What response do you have from your meetings with the shareholders and also in the conventions, and also the fact that it's been hanging around here? You may not be all that happy. I guess most people aren't too. I think exploration vehicles today are still being heavily discounted, but given the expertise that you have and the great frontier that you're operating in, how will you judge the market here, the rest of your expectations?
Well, I'd love to see it $3, $4, $5, $6. And certainly after the Bloomberg story came out, we were briefly up as high as $7.50. We've drifted back. It's certainly not been through lack of news. In fact, we were going from strength to strength, and Crunchy Hill is very much a milestone in the history of this company. So, you know, there isn't a lot of stock out. There's still questions about liquidity. That will be improved over time. I might add that, you know, with my former company, Aurelian, it was a similar sort of situation. The stock was very tightly held. But when we started to have great success with exploration, the fact that it was tightly held is the reason why the share price went up so much. So there's pros and cons to this. Certainly we're in the exploration business, and we are bullish that we're going to make some discoveries here. I can't tell you right now what the size and grade of these discoveries are. You know, that's that we it's wait and see. But the whole point of our exploration and having so much ground is to have so many targets that if one or two don't come up to standard, we have lots and lots of other things in our back pockets to play with. So I think that it's very important to remember that this is not a one-hit story like many, many other juniors out there that have a very small land position and really one target, and it's kind of a Hail Mary situation, and if it doesn't work out, the company's done. This is very, very far from that sort of a situation. So, you know, over time, we'll have more and more targets, both copper targets and gold targets on this property. And I think that we'll be going from strength to strength.
And Terence, I think on a, you know, from a sort of broader perspective as well, you know, on the copper side and the gold side, there are not many resources being added around the world. You know, everyone's talking about the electric metals, and copper is the ultimate electric metal. It's just not seen to be particularly sexy at the moment. And, you know, there aren't big discoveries being made. There are a couple, but not at the rate that we need to be making them. And the majors are not making those discoveries. It's the smaller companies that are, as is normally the case. So, you know, the bad rap that the explorationists are getting at the moment is going to be a short-lived thing. Ultimately, what is going to drive these companies and drive the value in them is discovery.
There is absolutely nothing wrong with copper or gold for the matter. I think it's a great combination. Individually or jointly, it's not an issue. I think the world needs more of them. No, you're absolutely right. Maybe one final question. But this is not the time or anywhere near the time to bring a partner anywhere in those properties, right? Am I right? I thought I asked that question before to you, but it's too early in the exploration program. It's not a question of money. It's a question of strategy. And you're not entertaining any issue like that, are you?
No, not at this point. We want to add value to this before we entertain any possibilities like that. And we think that we've got a lot of value to add. You know, we've only really examined about 15% of this property so far. And even then, we've come up with some fabulous targets. And it seems like every week there's something more that's coming back from the field. So, I don't want to be giving anything away cheap at this stage. You know, we'll hang in there until, I mean, if we have a real flood of targets, then of course we'll have to do something. But remember, this is a very large property. We have a lot of flexibility. So we could potentially sell off one target. We could JV some. We could say vend out the copper rights and keep the gold rights. There's lots and lots of possibility here. So you know, we'll examine this situation as it progresses. But certainly today, I'm not interested in partnering up with anyone.
Fair enough, guys. And thank you for hosting the conference call. I appreciate that. Thank you.
Thanks for your questions.
The next question comes from Mark Fields. Please go ahead.
No, and again, thank you for hosting the call, both Keith and Richard. I was wondering, with one of the attributes of the project is that I consider very positive is the large size of it. And for the airborne survey that was done originally, you've got a couple of questions. One was how much of the project has been covered by the current airborne survey? And then after that, how many has all that data been processed now? And if so, what's the status of the field checking of those targets that have been identified through that airborne survey?
Just to clarify, 100% of the project area was flown, and it's a little embarrassing because, you know, in our original press releases, you would have noticed that we said that we would sort of talk about the results as they went. as the survey was flown, and we obviously didn't do that because we were seeing a couple of trends that we didn't expect to see, that's why we've been quite shy about any data that we've released, and you'll obviously see that any images of the geophysics that we release never have coordinates on them, because we've seen a lot of targets. And, as I mentioned on the Awacha target, I mean, that was the first time that we had actually been able to link something at surface, something geologically that we could see in the streams and the areas adjacent to the streams with one of the red blobs on the geophysics. And that was a fundamentally important step. And so from that, we are moving on to some of the other red blobs. And in fact, that's where the most recent target came from, which happens to be that epithermal target, but that came from follow-up of a geophysical, something that looked interesting on the geophysical data. In terms of final processing, we're right at the end of that processing at the moment, but the way that it works, obviously, is that it's iterative. As soon as we get data back in from the field, we pass that back to the geophysicist, and then he tweaks the other targets, basically to say, okay, if you've seen this related with that red blob, let me rework the data. So, in terms of a final interpretation, we would never release that data because it just doesn't suit us to. It's far better for us just to work quietly on that data internally. And when we've got something to talk about in terms of the identification of a target, then we'll talk about it as we have been doing both with Awacha and Chari.
Good. Thank you. And I guess just with respect to the field checking, I guess that's also going to be a very long-term process because just from the targets you have right now, there's quite a few of them there. So it's that process is going to take quite some time, I guess. Any idea of sort of maybe a description of where you're at as far as the priority target schools at this point in time?
I would hesitate to say how many geophysical targets we've got because there are a lot. We at this stage are we've selected a couple for various reasons, and those are the ones that we're starting to field check. But as we field check each one, it helps us to refine the other targets. So it's a process that is iterative, but it should speed up as we go. I think ultimately we will need to do joint ventures, as Keith mentioned just now, or possibly vend off some targets. But we would only do that when shareholders have a feel for how many targets are out there. We need to make it a relatively transparent process.
Good. Thank you. Well, good luck with the ongoing program then.
Thanks very much.
Thanks, Mark.
There are no further questions in the queue. As a reminder, it's *1 on your telephone keypad. Okay, we have no questions in the queue.
Thank you, Liz. And thank you, everyone, for your questions. And thank you, Keith and Richard, for taking the time to explain Aurania's projects and the progress you guys have made to date. If any of the participants on the call have follow-up questions, please do not hesitate to contact myself, your Red Cloud representative, or Aurania, and we'll get the answer that you're looking for. Thank you.
Thank you for joining today's call. You may now replace your handsets.